Fighting well is the pursuit of a lifetime. You may be at mile marker one of this wonderful life journey and thinking for the first time about embracing the life of a writer. Or maybe you're further along and ready to publish some of your ideas. I'm Melissa Parks with Dade Getz, and we are fellow travelers on this extended road trip to improve our writing and publish our ideas. We hope this podcast helps you make progress on your writing journey. Now, let's buckle up and write. The book publishing journey doesn't always start with writing the book. It often starts with a book proposal, especially if you want to pursue traditional publishing. But how do you get a book proposal in the hands of a publishing house? You might need a literary agent. Today, Octavia Gordema, author of the book Prep, Push, Pivot: Essential Career Strategies for Underrepresented Women, talks about how she landed a relationship with a literary agent, secured a book deal with Wiley, and what it looked like to write a book while growing her business. In this episode, Octavia generously shares her experience and provides nuggets of insight throughout about how to grow your influence, how to use social media to market your book, and how to get published in external publications like the Harvard Business Review. Stick around for the entire episode. Octavia will encourage you no matter where you are in the book publishing journey. Welcome, Octavia, to the Writing Podcast. We are so happy to have you today with us.
Oh, thank you, Melissa and Dave. I'm so happy to be here.
So, Octavia, you're an award-winning career coach who helps professionals reach their full potential at work. Can you give us a brief overview of your work and how you fell into this profession?
I'm really passionate, as you said, about what it takes that often lies behind the scenes that no one else knows about. What it takes for you to do your best work, to land that opportunity, to get the promotion, to navigate the in-between phases, maybe when you're looking for that next opportunity or dealing with a difficult boss or perhaps don't have a role at all and are trying to figure out what you do next. And so I've been working as a career coach for the past few years, but I actually started my career in England, in London. I'm now based in Los Angeles, and I was working up the ranks in a career in communications, and it looked like I was doing everything right, you know, assuming more responsibility, relocating overseas with the company I worked for, had my own office, teams in different parts of the country, and my career was progressing, but I was really unfulfilled. And it wasn't until a chance encounter with a coach that I even realized that career coaching was an option. You probably class me as mid-career at that point. And that eureka moment for me actually proved to be a career pivot for me as well. And I trained to become a coach myself shortly after that. So fast forward to today, I've worked with an array of companies and organizations across the United States and beyond, from American Airlines to Google. I taught classes at NYU last year. I've spoken at scores of academic institutions. I'm running alongside my work as a career coach. I wrote a book which encapsulated a lot of what I was doing in my coaching work and my own experiences from my career.
I wanted to ask you, though, for those who might be facing something like you were facing, which is you kind of climb the ladder and you realize, I'm really not interested in this ladder anymore. You're not fulfilled. And you had that eureka moment that you mentioned. How long from the time you had that eureka moment to where you kind of were able to make a living doing what you really want to do? What is that, a 2-year, 3-year journey?
When I think back on it, I think it was probably roughly 2 years, maybe 18 months. At first, I thought I was going to make a gradual transition and explore, but it ended up being actually, no, I'm going to leave my role and jump in. And so I ended up making quite a sharp pivot. And that was after I started training as a coach. I then realized, actually, I just want to jump in and try it. I had no idea what it would require or take of me. So I feel very fortunate to have been able to, it didn't feel like I was hitting the ground running in the moment at all because I didn't know what was about to come next. But yes, it wasn't an immediate moving from one to another and it's a success story, even though I did start to work with companies relatively quickly. When I look back on it, I was learning as I was going. I was learning about how to actually do this, how to line up, not just do the work, but also how to find my next clients, how to grow those relationships, and also realizing that I was in the driving seat now for my career. Now there were no excuses. So what did I want to do next? Where, how did I want to fill those gaps? I could no longer say, oh, well, I'm trapped in a 9-to-5 and I can't do this, I can't do that. Now I had all the choices. And so navigating that transition, I was elated every morning when I woke up. I was like excited to get to work and also excited to write as well and have the time to do that alongside my work. My own personality is that I like doing different things. And so I'm very much what I consider maybe a dual careerist. I like having different things that I do at the same time. So for me, it was perfect. But yes, there was a lot of ups and downs on that journey as I was navigating it and figuring out how to make that work for me.
How did you find your first client? And then as you continued to grow your business, what did you find was the best way to market yourself, especially to like these enterprises where it sounds like you did coaching within an organization?
My first client, and actually I would say almost all of my clients I found through my writing when I think about it. So my very first clients, when I was training to become a coach, I thought we would go through all the theory and the best practices and I would read lots of books and do lots of exercises in my training. Actually, what they said is you need to start coaching right away. Start applying these things in real time. And I was like, wait, what? Right now? Literally at the beginning. And I had what was in essence really a blog. I had a website where I would share career development advice and perspectives. Before I even knew that I was going to become a coach, I was writing about these topics because I was really interested in them. And so I had an audience there. And so I wrote a post and said, I'm offering some career coaching sessions. If anyone would like to sign up, I'm taking 5 people this winter. Those were my first clients. And then from there, it just kept growing. I write pretty broadly, not just on my own platforms and not just my book, but I had an article published this morning by Harvard Business Review. I've often written in other spaces and consistently people have found me through my writing.
That's so interesting. We interviewed somebody last week about cultivating your online following. And she said one of the 4 key things is to be consistent with what you're writing and how you're connecting. And that's so interesting to me that that's how you started was with writing this blog. How did you attract people to your blog and to your writing? Because you probably started out with nothing and went to something where people were connecting with you.
I really wish I could tell you exactly what it was. I actually don't know, except I think it was just sharing what mattered to me and it resonated with the audience that was reading it. I was hired as a coach for the first time. If I really look back, before I even made the decision to become a coach, because an international travel company seen my work, my writing, and they were looking for 2 coaches to appear in a national media campaign, and they chose me to be one of them. I wasn't even a coach at that point. I was just writing about these topics. They reached out to me, and I was confused when they reached out to me. So I thought, well, they must have a long list of people they're interviewing. No, they'd already decided they wanted to work with me and wanted to know how much I would charge. And so my writing was, in addition to my own eureka moment that happened separately, but my writing pulled me through into so many opportunities. And when I was writing whichever post I was working on at the time, I didn't know that would be the outcome necessarily. I didn't know where it would take me. And so I also find now, even to this day, when I'm thinking through an idea or an opportunity, it's my writing that often is the key for whatever I do next. It's my channel. And so I always knew I wanted to be an author, but it took me a very long time to get to that point and to actually just lean into that and just to go for it.
So if you had to self-assess your own writing, what is it that you think that people connect with, and why are they reaching out to you to become a speaker? Because what is it about your writing that makes them think we got to have her?
A lot of people tell me that once they then meet me, if they hadn't met me before they read my work, that I talk like how I write. And I guess in you were to extrapolate that further, maybe that it's relatable and maybe it's honest and authentic. But in all honesty, it isn't really about me. It's about what they find useful in what I share. And often the things that people find useful aren't the things that I automatically think might be useful. It could be just a stray anecdote that resonated. Or I often get feedback on something that I wrote perhaps often quite a while ago that touched someone or helped someone in a way that I actually hadn't fully anticipated when I sat down and did that. And also, you're almost always writing in a vacuum. There's no real-time feedback. Yes, you might have a developmental editor that's working with you and gives you feedback then. But outside of that, it's not until you've put your work in the public domain, and that's whether that's a blog post or an article for a media publication or a book, it's a long time after you've perhaps come up with the idea for what you're sharing and put it on paper and printed it or published it, that you might hear anything about how it feels to someone. So when you're doing what you're doing, it's always almost in a vacuum. And the way that I always start is, what interests me? What did I perhaps need to know at that point when I'm thinking about the topic? Or what have I just uncovered that I think is actually really useful? And that's where I always start.
So I want to get to your book, Prep, Push, Pivot. But before we turn there, you mentioned that this morning you are published in the Harvard Business Review. I'd love to hear about that article. And also, how did that process go in getting published with them? Did you pitch them? Did they reach out to you? How did that work? I think that'd be valuable to so many people to hear about that.
The article that was published this morning is about how employers can invest in their early career remote professionals. When I started my career 24 years ago, I was the most junior person in the office, but I had the privilege of being able to look around. And I learned so much just from observing how people more senior than me navigated their day. And for so many people now, they can't do that. We have technology, which means we can work wherever we want to, which is fantastic, and we can connect. And you and I can talk right now, thanks to technology, and that's brilliant. I didn't have that at the start of my career in any capacity. But there are also some trade-offs in that it can sometimes be really difficult to figure out how you navigate what you're meant to be doing. And so I wrote an article about that and also about the work that I'm now doing now, which is about providing a way for employers to make sure their employees track their work accomplishments in real time and don't wait for that validation in their performance reviews or in meetings with managers. So the article was about that. But in terms of how I started working with Harvard Business Review, it was because of my book. And my book wasn't even written then. I had a mentor who's a published author who I had raised my hand to say, I need to talk to other authors who have done this because I want to be a traditionally published author. And he lent his support to me. And then after I got my book deal, he introduced me the Harvard Business Review team, and they asked me to present my book to their entire team. My book was not written yet. And I was like, okay, I said yes. And so I put together a slide deck and shared what I planned to do with my newly acquired book. And they loved what I shared, and I've worked with them since then. I started co-hosting an online show for their platform, and now I write articles for hpr.org, their website.
What a journey you've been on, and persistence and connecting with other people. It's all part of the formula. Let's move to your book, Prep, Push, Pivot, Essential Career Strategies for Underrepresented Women. Can you tell our audience what inspired you to write this book, and how did you balance writing your book with your career, your coaching career? I would imagine you were deep into that and trying to build that as you write.
With my book, I know how valuable coaching is, but I also know most people, especially the people who need it the most, don't have access to it. Either they don't know that it exists, like how I I was a director at my company and had no exposure to coaching of any kind until I accidentally met the person who became my coach. But even if you are aware of it, coaching is very expensive, like really expensive. So either you have to have a certain income level to be able to afford to make that investment yourself, or your company has to have made the decision that they will make that investment, not just at a company level, but that they've actually chosen you within the company to invest in. And so there's a lot of people who fall between the gaps there. And so I wanted to create a resource that someone could use if they didn't have a coach that they could work with one-on-one. And the reason I wrote a book for underrepresented women was, as a Black woman myself, I know what it feels like to be the only person of color, maybe in a meeting or on your team, or perhaps even in the building. And it's not just the loneliness that you might feel at work, but often we might be the onlys in our broader networks too. We might be the only people in our friendship groups that are doing the work that we do. We might be the only people in our families that are walking the career path that we're walking right now. Our networks, not just in work matter, but also more broadly too. And so Prep Push Pivot guides the reader on how you can identify the career values that matter the most to you, no matter what stage of your career you're at, and how you can be an advocate for those at every stage. How you can negotiate your salary, how you can position yourself for promotion, how you can plan to maybe step back if you need to. If you might be a caregiver that perhaps has a young family or older relatives that you need to support while you're growing, how you can do both of those things, how you can change careers if you choose to. I've done that. But also how you can pay it forward and be pivotal to the career advancement of others. So that's the book. And in terms of how I wrote it, you are right. I was growing my coaching business at the time, and I also was hosting a weekly online show for Harvard Business Review while I was writing my manuscript as well. I had three things happening at exactly the same time. And I have to be honest, I was really afraid about how can I do this? How will I make this work? And what I had to do, and I'm sure almost every writer realizes, is why you have to kind of just focus on the next step that you need to do. You need to also pay attention to what do you need to do your best work as a writer? How do you get into that sense of flow? What environment is right for you? What time of day is best for you? How do you work best? And really hold that to be sacred, because I've taken on additional responsibilities as well as my book. I also have to be very intentional about saying no to other things. I had to say no to the Girl Scouts. My daughter's a Girl Scout. I couldn't host meetings during that time. You know, there were things that I had to say no to, and that was hard, but it was important. I had to make space because of the additional responsibilities that I had taken on. Those responsibilities were really important to me.
What were your own writing rhythms? What did you find worked for you?
It's really interesting, Dave, because when I was writing my book proposal, which laid the foundation for me getting a book deal, I set the intention there that Mondays were my writing day. And what I came to realize is after I got my book deal and I was trying to fit in writing in between meetings that I had as a career coach and production meetings for the show that I was hosting during that time, it didn't work. I couldn't just be, oh, it's 9:30. I'm going to click into my writing now. I'd often just sit there and just stare at the screen and it wouldn't come. And then it'd be 11 and I have to move on to my next meeting. So what I found was actually I needed to give myself bigger periods of time. What that meant was that I was often writing in the evenings because I had fewer distractions later in the evenings. And yes, on weekends, because for me, I find I get into flow. It takes me a while to kind of sometimes get into it. The other thing that I did also is when I felt I didn't have the space to get into flow, but I did have some deadlines I had to meet for my writing for my book, I would talk to the page. So I'd hit the dictate button in Word, and Google Docs has a similar button too. And I would just talk through some of the things that I was thinking of and then give myself space later to refine those things and work on them a little bit more if I had a really small window to get some things done.
That's a really fresh strategy. I love that idea. Take some of the pressure off so you're still thinking and moving forward without the pressure of having to craft sentences, which is where so many people get stuck. You mentioned being published with Wiley. I'm curious about, one, why you wanted to be traditionally published, and two, did you work with a literary agent to develop a book proposal? And what did that engagement look like? How did you even land a literary agent?
The reason I decided I wanted to be traditionally published was just a personal one. I'd explored a book opportunity many, many years prior to the book that I have now with a much smaller independent publisher. And they ended up going under while I was in the process of working on that project. And that really scarred me. And it doesn't mean that that would have happened again. Lightning doesn't strike twice. But I just wanted to do things differently. This time I was also in the United States, whereas that project had gotten started in the UK. And I just felt there was an opportunity. And I think I trusted myself more as a writer. That said, I didn't know if I would get a traditional book publishing deal at all. But I made the decision. I wanted to see what would happen if I just didn't give up and just see what happened next. And so because I decided I wanted to try that and see what happened next, I figured having an agent was the first milestone marker. If I could get a literary agent, then the chances were much greater for me to get a traditional publishing deal. So I set out to get an agent. So I put together a book proposal, and then I used a free resource, Query Tracker, I believe it's called, and it's a database of literary agents. And you can literally go in and you can plug in the genre of book that you want to have published, and you can see which agents are accepting queries right now for that type of book. And so it pulled a list of, like, I had a list of 113 potential agents I could reach out to. I went and looked at every single one. I went and looked if they worked at a company. I looked at their company website. If they were solo agents, I kind of looked up, you know, their social media profiles. And I created, like, kind of three buckets in terms of, oh my gosh, this would be a dream kind of representation if it was ever possible, and then kind of work down from there. And I read a lot about how you then query and how to outreach. And something I read said, kind of do it in buckets of roughly five agents at a time when you're submitting your queries and give them chance to respond and then move on to the next. And so that's what I did. Within 4 weeks, I received an email asking for a meeting.
And so what did it look like taking that first proposal that you worked on your own, yes, and then working with the literary agent to refine it, to get it ready to be pitched to publishers?
So I had worked on my own proposal, I think, for almost 9 months. I'd worked on it for a long time. And then my agent and I did refine it. We spent maybe 4 or 5 weeks making some updates to it. And then the agency started pitching it. From that point, things moved really quickly. But I was actually terrified because I signed with my agent, I think it was early February 2020. And then we all know what happened from March 2020 onwards. And her agency sent everyone home immediately, as so many employers did. And my immediate instinct was, she's probably going to lose her job. And even if she doesn't, the people that she would pitch, everyone's kind of got everything on hold right now. This is the worst possible time to have a brand new project literally about to go out. And it certainly wasn't easy, but I did get a book deal. And so it goes to show sometimes you just never know, even when it looks like all the circumstances are working against you.
Before we get on to your work with Wiley, can you, without going into specifics, describe what it financially looks like to work with a literary agent? Because I think that they're doing some of the work. And so part of the contract is they're getting a certain cut of the book deal. I don't know if you can tell us what that looks like without having to go into details.
I know there were other authors that have gotten book deals without agents, but I know for a fact I would not have gotten a book deal without mine. And so a literary agent doesn't take any money from you up front, but they will only represent you if they have a pretty strong feeling that they will be able to sell your book. It's not guaranteed that they can. Some books might take a long time to get to the point where they're acquired. So at the point when they do then sell your book, you'll get, my agreement was so long from Wiley, it was so long. And so then your agent will negotiate the terms of that agreement. That negotiation actually took 6 weeks from when Wiley first gave it to us, there was a lot of back and forth on different clauses. Some things were changed, some things were not changed. And my agent knew what each and every one of those clauses meant and was able to give me counsel. I would not have been able to do that by myself. If I hadn't had an agent, I would have had to get an entertainment attorney to look over those clauses and do that for me. There would have been no way I could have understood. I'd never done this before. And so then, yes, your agent gets a percentage of your advance and they get a percentage of your royalties. And the royalties vary dependent on, but it's hardcover book and ebook. The percentages vary and the market is quite complicated. But yes, they get a percentage of what you earn from your book for perpetuity from that point onwards for as long as the book is in print.
I love this conversation about using a literary agent because lots of people skip over the literary agent. Maybe they have an insider who can get them into the publisher, but there's something very valuable that a literary agent does that you pointed out, which is they know the legalese, they know how to read the fine print and how to counsel you. So there is value in that. Because those agreements can be so complex. And when you're a new author, especially, they are
so complex. And even before that, I didn't have connections at publishing companies. I wasn't able, my agent was part of an agency and they have relationships. You know, they've sold books to other publishers before. My agent had not sold to Wiley before and she went on to sell more books to Wiley after she sold my book. So it was the first relationship with Wiley specifically, but they had relationships with other publishing houses. And so there's a depth of expertise and perspective and knowledge of the market that is incredibly helpful. I mean, of course, before I got an agent, I started reading Publishers Weekly. I got a subscription of my own. I was reading about the deals that were being done and the sorts of books that were being acquired because I wanted to have my own knowledge. I think it's very important as an author to have that. Even if you have representation, it's good to know what's happening in the marketplace. It's good to connect names at publishing houses and to just understand a little bit more before you see a book available for pre-order to know what's coming and trends in the marketplace. I'm endlessly curious as a person. I like to understand how industries work and what's happening behind the scenes. So I did all of those things. But even with that knowledge, my agent was able to get my book in front of so many more people and also protects you a little bit from the immediate rejection, right? So, you know, she would, she would give me periodic updates. And then when you have provisional interest from a publisher, you then have a meeting with your potential acquisition editor. And, you know, I had two of those meetings before I had a meeting with Wiley with two other publishers. And, you know, she guided me on how to prepare for those conversations. She was with me for those conversations. And then when those were no's, she was able to explain to me what the process would be next and then go back out to market again. And so it takes some of the pressure off you as well, because you know that you've got someone that's working on your behalf to get your book in front of as many of the right people as possible.
So in your proposal, how much emphasis did you put on your own platform, meaning your ability, quote unquote, to sell books? We know the platform's such a big thing. Was that one of the areas that your literary agent assisted you in kind of beefing up? And any insights on that as it relates to your own platform and how it shaped Wiley's interest in your book?
Platform is really, really important. So even to get an agent, you have to have given a lot of thought to that. If an agent isn't cold contacting you, which wasn't the case with me, I was pitching agents or querying agents. That's how I got my representation. Some agents are actually proactively looking for people they want to work with. But if you're querying agents like I was, and agents that you haven't been introduced to, who don't know you at all, which is the case with me, you got to have a really tight proposal together. And it's not just why you're a great writer or how passionate you are about this topic. Publishing is a business. And so it's how will you shift those books? What do you already have that will facilitate that? It's a while ago that I looked at my proposal. I don't know if we changed a lot after I got my representation to actually going out to start submitting my proposal to publishing houses. But I do know that when I started taking meetings with publishing houses, that was where all the questions were, because ultimately those acquisitions editors, have to go to their board of editorial peers with your book proposal and advocate for why their publishing house should choose you. And everyone in that room has to vote and agree on that. And the reason they're going to agree on that is if they feel that you've got a platform that can deliver whatever metrics they're putting against how many units they think they will print in that first run for your book.
What did your platform look like when you presented it?
My platform even today is not large. But what I had, I think, and I can't answer this objectively because I don't know how I compare to what else they were looking at that time. But I was able to offer maybe a unique perspective on the type of book that my ultimate acquisitions editor didn't have on her list at that moment in time. I have dual nationality, based here in the United States, but originally from the United Kingdom. I have a title from the Queen for the work that I do. I have relationships in other markets as well as the market that I'm in here now. So I remember my proposal, I think, talked about that. And there were a lot of things that I proposed that I actually did do, but there were a lot of things that actually ended up happening for my book and the marketing. No idea were going to happen and that I went with. But I did know from the outset that I would have the responsibility to drive the awareness for my book. And so I was very proactive in hiring a small team to work with me as we moved closer to the launch of my book. To do that, I knew I would not just be able to sit back and be, oh, I have a publisher. That's all it will take. No, I had to be proactive.
So as you think about from the time you decide, I don't know how you launched your book, but from that moment, what would you say were the top two or three things that you did that you found to be the most effective? It's always hard to measure because it's just hard to measure these things because you don't get direct results from the publisher, right? From what you know, what do you think was most effective? And if you, looking back, you do again for your next book?
There were two things. There was one which was just writing broadly. And that, I mean that in every sense. So on social media, I'm inherently a writer. That comes easier to me than maybe making videos or doing other things. And so sharing my writing broadly was definitely and continues to be. And then the other thing was working with a book coach for my launch, that specifically. And my book coach answered questions for me. She didn't tell me what to do, but it gave me a safe space to talk through how I was feeling about launching my book, to troubleshoot some things. Because the thing I think I realized as I was getting closer to the launch is it all comes down to you, even when you have a team supporting you, which I did, because you wrote the book. So you have to be the person that perhaps helps distill how that message will be shared. If you have the opportunity to be interviewed on podcasts, or on national TV, which I did, and or to speak events, it's you. You are the person who shows up and does that. And so it gets really tiring when you're doing that concentrated push in the build-up to your book launch and during your book launch. And I was really, really, really terrified about how I would show up well during that phase. And so I started working with a book coach who was just phenomenal. And she supported me. My book came out in January. I can't remember exactly when we started working together, but I feel like it was probably around the November timeframe, December timeframe before my book came out. And then she worked with me through my book launch period.
You mentioned there were some unexpected marketing activities that you just went with. What were some of those? Was it the TV appearances, or what were those things that you're like, man, I didn't see this coming, but I'm going to go for it?
I'd actually, and this isn't anything I'd recommend to any other authors listening, this was just me and my shyness. I told my publicist I didn't want to do any television. And so, yes, when they booked me on four consecutive days, I said yes, of course, and did it. But yes, I was not expecting to do that. And what that meant was, because I'm in Los Angeles and I was doing East Coast timing broadcast, I had to be ready on camera in my office. We were doing virtual broadcast. I think it was, I had to be ready at 4 a.m. and it would go live maybe at 4:30 my time.
Oh my gosh.
7 a.m., 7:30. their time. What that meant was I also then had to be in makeup before that. And then I had to get to my office because I had a separate office at that time, not in my home. And so I remember in that book launch week, driving to my office at like 2:30 in the morning, being there, then my makeup artist coming in to get me ready and then getting ready and then being on camera. I say all of this as if this is a regular week for me. This is not a regular week for me. I had never done things like that ever before. So that was definitely unexpected. And then also other smaller things. I didn't inherently feel comfortable with social media. And so I've come out of my comfort zone big time. No one else would know this, but I really had to in preparation for my book. So that was as monumental for me as national television, just even figuring out how to navigate social media as an author. But also the other things that I also didn't realize is that having a book actually makes it easier to talk about your work because there's actually something tangible for you. You can think, oh, I'm not just talking about myself. I'm talking about a book. I'm talking about something that can help somebody. Someone can use it. And I think I'd underestimated that piece. So it actually became a lot easier to do once there was something to latch onto versus the before when you're platform building and maybe no one knows you've got a book coming. For me anyway, it was a lot harder to do then and it became easier once there was something tangible.
So you mentioned that embracing social media was a little bit new for you, but you'd been writing on a blog for years. So what was different in kind about blogging versus social media? What was the hurdle that you had to get over? Well, because it's writing, it's sharing, but different.
Yeah. But there's a lot of video component to social media now compared to when I first started writing on the internet. There was maybe Twitter and Facebook and that was it. And now there's so much video-driven marketing and content, and it can feel very, very overwhelming. People who are creating at the highest level, publishing content, not just daily, but sometimes maybe twice a day, maybe four times a day across different platforms. And just the quality of the content that's being shared is incredible. And so the time that takes, if you are the voice and face of that content, which you are as an author, because the work and the ideas are yours. I was like, how is this even possible? How would a book even get written if you were just to do all of these things? And so that to me was very, very, very different to anything I had ever experienced before. When I was writing before for my own blogs, websites, I would write an article, post a link.
What is your best advice for creating short form videos for social media? What have you learned works when you're sharing through video?
I wouldn't say that I'm an expert in that space at all. So what worked for me was I hired someone and she worked with me for about 18 months to be my social media consultant. And she was the one who guided me on what I should do. And then I learned some techniques from her and from working with her. But I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to start. I didn't know how to start to pull out, distill ideas. And then there's also the technical components of it, how to make the formats compliant with what the different platform needs are and all of those things. And so I've always lent on the counsel of others. I hired a PR team to work on my book, Smith Publicity. They were fantastic. I've always respected the counsel and perspectives of other people. When it came to my author website, I hired Dan at AuthorPop. He built great sites for other authors. I lent on his expertise on what I should have and how to do that. That has always been my approach. When I don't know how to do something, talk to other people who know how. If you can, hire them to help you. And if you don't have the budget to hire someone, talk to as many people as you can and learn from them.
What I hear you saying in this podcast, which I think is so helpful, there's the writing of the book, and then there's this whole professionalism that surrounds the book that if you're not innately good at, or if you're not trained in, there are people who can support you and guide you through that. And I love that idea of reaching out for support. And thank you for sharing that, because I think it's really hard for people to say they they can't do it all. They don't want to do it all. They don't know how to do it all. And so I think you're giving a lot of freedom to people.
I really don't know how to do it all. And I cannot sit here and say that even 2 years after my book coming out, that I know exactly how to do it all, because I don't. And what I do now that I'm past the launch phase of my book, but I still market my book, is that I really play to my strengths and what I've learned from that process. And it builds a momentum of its own. Reporters that I spoke to during the launch phase of my book come back to me and ask me if I want to contribute to other things that they're working on. People see, because there's a compounding effect of when you are sharing what you do, however it is that you're sharing, whether you're speaking in front of a room of 2,000 people, which I sometimes do with my book, or whether, you know, you're sharing an article on LinkedIn that you've written. There's a compounding effect in sharing what you know, and people will discover you at different points. There are people who've never heard of my book who will just suddenly discover it, and they don't care when it was published. They're discovering it now. What they're reading or seeing resonates with them. That's what matters. And so I think I put a lot of emphasis on the launch, and that launch is important, but actually your work and your book has a life cycle that could extend a lot longer than you might ever anticipate.
That's a beautiful note to end on. Thank you so much for being with us today, Octavia. It's been one of my favorite interviews, because you've shared this beginning to end process really completely and with such vulnerability and grace. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for the invite.
All right, Dave, let's turn to our words of the episode. You go first. I went first last time.
So here's one that I honestly have never seen or heard this word before. It's called hirsute, H-I-R-S-U-T-E, hirsute. It's an adjective. And I got it from a New York Times obituary, a 94-year-old man named Bob Moore, who was founder of Bob's Red Mill. So I think the reason it made the New York Times obituary was it's this behemoth global natural foods company. So it was founded in Milwaukee in 1978. And it grew from serving the Portland area, which is interesting, to become this global natural foods behemoth. And it marketed more than 200 products in more than 70 countries. So he passed away. So Mr. Moore, he was known for he had this trademark, red vest and white beard. So he kind of looked like Santa Claus. So the hirsute, the word, this is how they used it in the obituary. While Bob's Red Mill is an ensemble effort in that sense, its marketing appeal is rooted in the cult of personality surrounding its hirsute founder. And it means hairy or hoary, which not hoary is probably more distant, but it's someone who's covered with hair, right? Haired.
I love that word. I've known that word for a while. It's probably one of those words I learned in high school when I was memorizing lots and lots of vocabulary. And I love it. And I love to pull it out every once in a while when I see a hairy man without a shirt on, you know, really, really hairy. Like, that's a hirsute individual.
There's nothing more gross than that on some levels.
it provokes such an image in my mind that I love that word.
Well, I always tell my boys, we should be grateful because we don't have hirsute chests. We just don't. We're just, it's not a gets thing, which is kind of a blessing.
It is a blessing. Jerry doesn't either. He has like one hair like that pops out of his chest. He is the opposite of hirsute.
And it's hirsute, not hirsute.
Okay, hirsute. Okay. Hirsute, yeah. I've been saying it wrong all these years. All right.
It's hirsute, yeah.
Hirsute. But H-I-R, not H-E-R.
That's exactly
right. Sounds like hirsute. Hirsute. All right. Well, there you go. I'm going to say it right from now on. All right. My word of the episode is rematriating or rematriation. And this was in a long read article that I dipped into. Of course, I've heard of repatriation, which typically involves returning something to its country of place or origin. So a museum returns sacred artifacts and ancestral remains to indigenous communities in accordance with their cultural and religious beliefs. Rematriating or rematriation is a term that has to do with the process of returning to or reclaiming or revitalizing indigenous knowledge, practices, lands, and cultures, often led by indigenous women. So like if you're trying to replant and do bring back a certain type of vegetable native to the land that would be called rematriation. So
what a great word.
Yeah, I love it. I love that it has a more feminine side to it. Matriarch. It's interesting when you look at patriarch and matriarch, right? What the activities of these two words are associated with. Anyway, fun word to know. I don't know how often I'll use it, but it's good to know the difference. Well, what a great episode this has been today. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed your questions. I enjoyed Octavia. I think that's it. I'm Melissa Parks.
And I'm Dave Getz.
Now buckle up and write.